So thank you so much to the DJ, and thanks for the openers and the folks who volunteer to keep this space intact. Without a container like this, I would have had nowhere to go to start breaking the rule of don't talk and to come out of hiding. So thank you. My name is Amy, and on an unburdened day, I am my own loving parent. And on a burdened day, I'm blended as an adult child of one of various ages. Sometimes I'm also in the false self, which is the form of me that serves to protect me from my perceived threats. Sometimes that's involuntary. But lately, I have enough awareness to be able to maneuver my way back to loving parent, sometimes quicker than others. I like to start off with a reading from the book. I'll kind of come back to the literature here and there because it helps me stay grounded. But this comes from Tony A, the founder, and it's in one of the appendices in the back. Recovery is a complex process. Sorry, I'm going to start my timer too. We cannot return to childhood and ask our parents to love us in the way we needed to be loved. It just cannot be done. As ACAs, we need to learn how to nurture and fulfill ourselves. We need to look within and find the origins of our feelings and come to understand our difficulties and the role we continue to play in causing them. This is all possible within the framework of the ACA program. Those of us who have lived through the nightmare of family dysfunction need a safe and secure environment where we can unburden ourselves, be brought closer to our painful childhood feelings, and learn that we are not alone in our struggle. As ACAs, we have paid a tremendous price to reach this point of recovery. And for me, that's true. This whole walk that I hope to take you down has been a journey. I learned that there isn't a destination, but little by little, I peel back the layers. And I'll just say that I've come to realize in hindsight that the bulk of my trauma really occurred by the age of 9. I don't know if anyone's heard of the Kaiser ACE study, but I'm a huge fan. And there's 10 adverse childhood events that contribute to a 4,000% greater likelihood of PTSD. And then all these behaviors that we do and ultimately premature death. And it's a horrifying statistic. And it tells me that a lot of us don't make it. And that breaks my heart. And I feel very grateful that I'm still here. And so by the age of 9, I met 9 of those criteria. And I've been told I'm a miracle. I know in hindsight I am. I know I've been guided and led by a higher power. I know I've been given so many surrogate attachment figures in the absence and ruptures of my attachment figures. I can see myself laced into that the whole way through. And of course, when I'm in a flashback or a trauma state, or I'm blended with one of my inners, I can't see it, but today I can, so I'm grateful for that. I also heard a psychologist say that your brain is a really clean slate from 0 to 7, and then your imprint for how you receive the world is really set in stone by that time. So this is, really taken a lot of undoing, and it's a really slow process, and it needs to be done gently. And with you guys on board, I can do that little by little, and I can't. I have to be really, really careful. So I will also tell you that the information I've gathered that I'm about to share with you has occurred in the form of memory flashbacks. I've interviewed my family members and loved ones to the best of my ability when I later on in my healing, I was able to get some information from them in hindsight. I learned somewhere in the middle, I heard a prayer. It's a prayer of Saint Francis, but one of the lines says, "Seek to understand, then to be understood." And for some reason, it hit me that if I sought to understand, maybe I could understand myself. And I started asking people to understand, and it helped me a lot. It helped me break free from some of my victim patterns of what happened to me and to need to be understood. So that is one of my sources of information. And then the rest has been me sitting in therapy sessions and piecing the stuff together. It's trauma sessions, it's brain spotting, it's EMDR, it's coming to meetings with you guys, and then somebody shares something and it kicks something off. It comes in the form of triggers, where I do the inner child work and get the story revealed to me. So I'm going to sprinkle that all throughout, but it's been quite the discovery process, as the ACA tells us that it's a twofold process, one of discovery and then to recovery. And discovery is not recovery. I would actually really love to hang out in discovery, but that doesn't necessarily fully get me well. I have to actually apply the tools and then I begin to recover. So I'll just start with the beginning. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I was born in Cheyenne, Wyoming, in 1982 to my mom and dad. We lived in poverty in some low-income apartments. My mom told me that she was really malnourished. She put change together for green beans. So I don't think she ate very well when she was pregnant with me. While she was pregnant, her father, my grandfather, died. My mom and my dad were separated at the time. And my d mom called my dad and said, my dad's died. And he couldn't leave her in that state. I also had a brother with special needs Down syndrome. He was 18 months older than me. And she was overwhelmed. There is no way she could have done it. That she didn't have a chance, you know, when I look at it that way. My dad had enough heart to come back to her. And she told me my whole life that I saved her. And that is one of my traits. It was to save my mother. And if I saved my mother, then I would be okay. So I was pretty groomed to be that part of the void inside of her. I was groomed to fill it. But it was interesting when my brother was born. There wasn't a lot of services for Down syndrome. He was busy, 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 and she was always following him around and trying to keep him contained. My dad was MIA, and there was one story that we were put in a crib together for the whole day, and I think she was checked out. She would drink coffee and Kahlua all day. And someone came back and I was covered in bite marks and I think he was teething and there wasn't any supervision. And so my body and my experience is that I never had boundaries. I never had a concept of body. It was always invaded. I shared a bedroom. We lived in a tiny spot. And then 2.5 years later, my little sister came. There was a neighbor down the street who actually really loved babies who moved in. And she was my sister's caregiver. She didn't want anything to do with my brother or I because we were more grown at the ripe age of 4. But my sister was really attuned to. And I remember seeing her get this nurturing that I didn't ever really know or understand. My mom's, attention became even more divided with the baby. And I just never felt like I got a chance. I was kind of sandwiched between. So I found a way to just stay away. I knew if I was good, I was a good girl. If I was good to my siblings, and then other than that, I was gone, which was really handy because she wasn't paying attention. I could go outside and roam wherever I wanted to. At 5 years old, I was crossing streets and going to Mini Mart and heading to neighbors' houses. And again, the evidence of a higher power is right there. I was always barefoot. I had a therapist tell me later I was grounding myself. Like my feet were on the grass constantly barefoot, and my nervous system stayed well in that position. My mom had really severe mood changes. Sometimes she was really, really angry. I would see a flash and I was like really, really scared of that part of her. Other times I would just want to wave my hands and I couldn't see her. She was really mad at my dad, preoccupied with him, crying sometimes. And I just didn't want to come home. Sometimes I would wet my pants before I would come home. When it was dark, I would head in. And I know now, especially during COVID, that when I'm home, I dissociate much, much more than when I'm not. That sort of tradition or that sort of behavior followed me for most of my life. And you'll hear later that I had a pretty robust drinking career, but it existed on Friday to Monday. So when I'm home, I can't be home. It scared me to be home and I wanted to disappear. So I was able to, and I also realized in hindsight that my inner child capacity to play was still intact despite all of the chaos. So I'm like, that's one of our miracle states is that we actually do know how to play. It's kind of a built-in mechanism. So my mom got a job at a gas station, and she got a night shift. And my dad said, "Those are ridiculous hours. I will not watch the kids. You should have got a job with better hours." And when I talk about my dad today, it's hard for me because I loved him dearly before he died. I love my mom, but my parts need to be honored, and this is what happened. And we've healed, but this is the truth then. So she met a lady who said, "My mom watches kids." And so we got dropped off at the trailer. Actually, I did. My sister was with the other babysitter down the hall. I don't remember my brother doing most of this. And the man of the house started molesting me at 4. And every night I would stay there, he molested me from the ages of 4 to 6. What's interesting is that during that time, all I remember is their house, their trailer, and playing outside with their dogs. And I remember they had horses. That's all. I would just remember the play. It's like my brain was able to recraft the entire reality. What I do remember are nightmares. I had really bad nightmares that I was in my bed and someone was coming in my room. And I had yeast infections and I had tantrums before not going over there, and I wet the bed. So all the signs were there, but I don't remember it, so I couldn't talk about it. And I just don't know. I don't have the language to talk about it. I'm sure I was groomed not to. And so that was those are the the things that happened at that time. At the age of 7, my mom and dad were able my dad was able to secure employment, and they got us out of the low income apartments and moved us into a house that they rented. And my dad was really smoking heavily and miserable, and he ended up quitting smoking. And all this stuff came up, and I learned later that he said, "I'm either going to come out as gay or I'm going to end my life." And that was at the age of 30. And so he actually went to therapy and told somebody that he was gay. My version of that is I was in kindergarten and I was sitting outside waiting to get picked up from school, and no one showed up. And I was, the kid sitting on the curb with no parents. And they called my dad. He came and picked me up and said, "I'm sorry, I forgot to pick you up. I bought a new CD and I was listening to it and I lost track of time." And I think that kind of really hits home for where his attention was at that time. He told me in the van that he was divorcing my mom, but it wasn't my fault. I think I felt actually a little, I was terrified that they were getting divorced. I was crying. I was worried, but I also felt this little relief that he said it wasn't my fault, which tells me that I always believed everything was. Like I think I was a good scapegoat. So I just already had this kind of built up idea that everything was my fault. This was a good move for my dad. He came out of hiding, his own version of it, and he kind of went on, launched into this life path of recovery and coming home to himself. It was terrible for my mom. In Wyoming, when you're gay, you don't get to be the primary caregiver of your children. You're lucky to have contact with them at all. There's still so much bigotry even now. And so my mom took custody of us, and my dad told me later that he was agonizing over how to be a part of our lives. So she moved us into a trailer, and she drank every day and she dissociated every day. Again, I was unsupervised. I was used to that. I had a few more memories of my brother and sister. I remember talking her into letting us have kittens. There was a person down the street selling them, and I took money from her wallet and walked my sister and brother down there, and I was like, "Well, just get kittens. The answer is kittens." So we walked down, we came home with these three kittens and had no food, the house was a disaster. But she didn't make judgment calls. She just would say yes and no. And I was outside again traveling and exploring. And I was really worried about her. So I was 8 and I was really, really worried about her. I learned later, my older cousin has a good friend that worked for UPS, and we ran into him, I don't know, 4 years ago. And he said that he remembers delivering packages to our house at that time when I was young. And I said, "What did you see?" And he said, "You were always in the front lawn playing in the sand, just kind of smiling, and you were friendly." And it just blows my mind that there's these adults around, but nobody sees. If somebody could have just come in and seen, they would have known. But if they didn't see, then I didn't see. I guess it was normal if the adults say that what's happening is normal. In hindsight, it kind of breaks my heart again. But from his version and viewpoint, everything was fine. There was a lot of ways that I knew she needed help. There was one night that she said, "I'm gonna sleep in the morning, so I put out your breakfast for you so that you can eat breakfast." And she put the milk out on the table overnight. And I was like, I think I was like, "Mom, the milk will spoil." So she just was not connected. There was one night my sister shook me in the middle of the night and she said, "Mom's gone and I'm really scared." I think she walked my brother with her down to the gas station. She'd make phone calls and buy alcohol. And I said, "That's okay, Jenny. We'll pack us up and I'll take us to the neighbor's house." So we go to the neighbor's house and I said, "We're kind of scared." They let us come in and sleep there. And they could have called social services. I'm glad they didn't. The next morning, we woke up early and I said, we got to get back because mom's going to be worried about us, and knock on the trailer door. And she opens it and she says, keep it down. I'm trying to sleep. And she had no awareness that we were gone, and she was not startled that we were gone. And I, something clicked into me at that point, you know, one of the traits of being, you know, or chronically self-reliant. And I was like, I think I'm on my own. I'm on my own. And I shoved that fear deep, deep down, and something snapped that said, you're going to have to take care of your sister and brother. You know, one night my sister said, Mom, are you ever getting out of bed? And she told me that was a trigger point for her to get help. And so it turns out she asked for help and she was sent to a treatment center in Denver. And this part is, you know, all of this is blocked from my memory. Except I do remember, my dad coming. Actually, my dad got a phone call, and said, your mom, you know, Terry's gone. The kids are there alone. They need you. And so I, you know, asked my dad the conditions that he walked into, and my brother was rocking on the couch and my sister's bawling. And he said, I just had this really wide-eyed look. And I remember the thought was that I failed to save her and to keep her here, and that I couldn't keep my mom home. You know, I was told there's no water, there's no electricity, there's cat poop everywhere. It's just really gross. And my dad had told me that 2 days before that, he said his first prayer ever. I think he dabbled in therapy, and he had said, you know, how will I be a part of my kids' lives? So that's how he became a part of our lives. When he came out, he called a support group in Cheyenne, and it was a party of one. And it was a man who he later said, you know, he fell into codependency instantly, but the man was older, and that was became his partner pretty quickly. So my dad was pretty preoccupied with the new relationship, and the guy was emotionally abusive. He didn't care much for us, but he was infatuated with my dad. So he was pretty preoccupied right away. It was interesting to have him back in my life as a caregiver because I didn't know him at all. I was mostly terrified of him. The version of him that I met at that moment was not the same person. He was literally changed overnight, which is wonderful. They tried to, you know, I learned later that my mom tried to integrate back home, but she had met somebody in treatment, and my grandma said, you made your bed, you're going to lay in it. There's no place for you here. And then my dad, and I didn't know this, no one ever told me until way later. And then my dad said, you can't come and go from their lives. Either you're going to stay or not. And he was, you know, mad at her that she met a new man. So she met a man, she never came back. That was her. She had three more kids there and fell deep, deep into opioid addiction. After that, my dad found a babysitter across the street, and that he was 14, and he came in and started molesting me. So I had a second episode of that for a full year. I'd finally started having supervision with my mom in Denver. We had visits, and I remember telling her about it, and she was mad at my dad for pushing her away, and she called him in the middle of the night and kind of gave him crap and said he made a poor decision for letting the babysitter come. But I also felt really sad because I knew she didn't come back and she was blaming him. And I just always felt kind of lost in the sauce on that. And when I told my, I think my dad, it jarred my dad, and he ended up moving us. So I think at this point, I just want to take a breath and really emphasize that all of my survival traits are deep in motion at this point. I haven't hit addiction yet, but my dad changing his life gave me a chance that I would have never had. What's interesting is he moved us to a new neighborhood that was really nice. I would spend the rest of my years there until I turned 18. And I have a memory of 10 years old playing on the playground. It was the first time someone paid attention to buy me school clothes, and I got school supplies, and there was like a purposeful effort to make sure I adjusted decently. What was weird though is that 0 to 9, not discussed, cut off, chopped off, wiped as if it never happened. So that's what the adults did. That's what I did. I do remember that with my basic needs being met, I felt upgraded. It was like it was like something I didn't know I needed, and I finally received. A lot of family messages, you know, it's a shame she left you. How could she do that? Thank God for your dad. He's the hero. If they would have just asked me, I would have told them I know why my mom left. She was dying. She was hurt. She was heartbroken, but they wanted to judge her. And what I would have asked is, why didn't she come back? Because no one told me. Third through sixth grade, I survived by people pleasing. I learned in this program, I had some really great assets. I was athletic. I had the gift of repression. I was very smart. Thank God for that. And I was able to actually enjoy a little peace at that time. My dad was an adult figure. He was preoccupied with his relationship. The man was more abusive to John than anybody, and it breaks my heart because I have a lot of witnessing of that. When seventh grade hit, you know, I became a teen and I have a lot of inner teen pain, and I have an inner teen. I have two, 13 and 16. And I started, you know, my cycle, and my dad, deer in headlights, freaked out, called my aunt. So I had a surrogate aunt who was my dad's sister, and she couldn't have kids, and she really took me in. My dad sort of started pulling away from me, mostly out of terror. I don't think he knew what to do with girls, but I did have a sis, an aunt. There were a lot of shame around the gay stuff, and lots of bigot remarks, sometimes teasing and mocking, and I hid it, and I felt deep, deep shame. I felt proud of my dad because he was alive and he was joining movements. He was doing great things, and I was going deeper and deeper into myself. So I found me girls who were popular, and I got best sense of humor in ninth grade, and I just stuck with them and stayed hidden. And I found that those girls who looked perfect actually had really deep hidden secrets in their families, including alcoholism. So I got drunk the first time at the age of 13. And 13 through 18, I had an escape hatch. I was able to use my survival traits of people pleasing and good grades and humor during the week. And Friday through Sunday, I got to be drunk. And that rinse and repeat till the age of 18. And this is all God. You know, I had teachers who believed in me. I was able to stay hidden, lead the double life, and have some structure and get my high school diploma. My dad was big on education. It helped him change his life. And he told me if I got a full ride scholarship for academics, he would buy my first car. At the age of 16, he told me, 15, he said, "You need to find a job. You're able-bodied. Get out and find a job. I can't drive. We'll pedal your bike, and you have to go apply to one place every single day." So at 15, I was late for school, and somebody said, "Do you want to work here at McDonald's?" I was like, "Absolutely. Then I don't have to apply for the jobs, and we'll kill two birds with one stone, and I'll take an English McMuffin and miss my first period." So our first hour of class. So I kind of went in late, but I got a job, and then I discovered workaholism. So I could add that to the list and start making money and get some autonomy. I'm really grateful for the work ethic that he taught me. When I went to, I did get that full ride, and I discovered social work, and I read the code of ethics, and I was like, this is it. I found my calling. And I feel on a soul level, it was my way of tapping into my own healing by using these words that these people spoke about how to reach other people. I was in pain, so much pain through my college years. I had parts constantly taking me over to repress everything from 0 to 9 that was trying to come out. I had zero concept of how to do that side of it. It was blocked, but it came out in these symptoms. And then I had this heart's desire to move forward and actually make something of myself. And I don't know if you guys identify with that battle. It's PTSD, and it's just tug of war and war zone constantly. More drinking so I could do more homework. And that was my life. I moved to Denver when I turned when I finished my undergrad and got a DUI right away. I was going 15 and a 45. So I was blacked out, and I was on my way to the bar, and my blood alcohol was like a 0.35. And she just said that that's an obscene amount of alcohol. But I was going to chase my mom down. She was still living there, and she was with that man. I got there for 2 days. I gave her a hug. And then 2 days later, I got a call from my grandma saying, "Your mom fled Denver. Her boyfriend got a second DUI." I remember she left me again, and it crushed me, and something dark happened in me. It was almost like an F you to the world, and I don't need anyone. Deep into the drinking, deep into the partying, I stopped caring. I showed up to work. I worked with at-risk youth. Me, I worked with myself, but for them. So I was always, you know, paying attention to others so I don't have to look at myself. I happen to be decent at it. And I just checked out. That kind of came to a head at the age of 26. I was suicidal. I was living check to check. I would make a payment on my credit card so that I could buy booze with a new balance and then to payment. And then I had a DUI, no driver's license. And I had a moment of clarity. This is God thing. We talk about it in the program. I either need to, you know, go I got this call to like go to grad school, go the next level, dive into this or check out. And I got this surge of energy, and I went and applied to the master's program, and the questions they started asking prompted me to start looking at these deeper wounds, and I started calling my mom drunk, and she was still deep in addiction, and I had stopped talking to her, and I said, "Why'd you do this?" And she cried and she said, "I hoped you would call me someday and I would get to answer these questions." And I'm lucky, not a lot of us get this from our parents. And she listened, she couldn't answer them. She was dissociated. And she took my calls though. And I was mad at her and I called her for another 4 years drunk. But I did move back home to Wyoming and went to grad school. And I started having severe panic attacks coming home. And I realized now that my inner child didn't know that dad was safe at this point. It was blocked. But here I am trying to, these wounds are trying to come forward. And what I learned moving back with my dad, he took me in and I went to school. He told me he was proud of me. And we used to go for really long walks. And he would start talking to me about the state of mind he was in during those years. And I will tell you guys that every single new moment that I do something different, I don't give in to resentment and trauma responses, I get to start all over. There's like these infinite opportunities for a new experience with these people who caused so much wounding. And I started healing back then. And I got, another do-over with my dad. I finished grad school, and at the same time, I met at the same time that I wanted to kill myself, a man came into my life also. But this was a man who actually asked me on a date. And before this, I was so damaged that if you asked me on a date, it scared the shit out of me. I didn't go on dates. I met people at bars and blacked out and whatever. But this man asked me on a date, and I still to this day we laugh. I don't know what he saw in me. I didn't even have a driver's license. We went go-karting because I didn't have a driver's license, but I could drive on the go-kart track. But he'll tell you his version, and we're still together. So that man, and rescuing by a man, that's not the answer. But I had two lifelines at that time that I cared enough about to keep taking one next step, and that was Josh, and that was grad school. We moved in together after 1 year, or after grad school. I started my career. I was still drinking every single weekend and working with people during the week. I was so good at it by this point. I was still very dissociative and disappearing into work. And our relationship progressed, and he told me later, I couldn't have married you, but I would never have left you because I was a mess still. I was drinking a lot, and he saved up a down payment money and moved us into this new house that was absolutely beautiful. And I got to co-sign on it, and I was shaking during the co-signature because I had binged so badly the weekend before. And in 2014, I called my mom drunk one more time. She cried. She apologized to me one more time, and I had another moment of clarity. And it was like, you can't keep blaming your mother. You're 31 years old. Your mom is sorry. You have to take responsibility for your life. And I didn't know how. I was like, but I don't know what to do next. And in hindsight, I'm praying, and I have this higher self talking to me. And I flashed to my cousin who had joined AA with heroin addiction, and I called him drunk and said, I need help. I showed up to an AA meeting that Monday, and I never drank again. The ladies there said, you never have to drink again, and if you stick around, we'll show you how. And that's how Tony A got here. He started in AA, and I met this woman who I stalked to become my sponsor, and she said yes, and she was the first safe attachment figure I ever had. She was the first woman who showed up for me and did the work to hold a container for me to act out against, constantly calling her, whining, breaking up with her, starting again, refusing to do it. And she always just stayed right there. I started having my attachment wounding come out on her. And I learned two big things at that 5 years in AA. I got a God concept in step two. I had a lot of some religious abuse, and I was being molested at the same time as I was going to church, being told, that I'm evil and all these things, and not being protected. I had no concept of protection. And in step two, they told me to write down all the words that about God that freaked me out, that made me shut down. And I wrote all of those words. And then they told me to define them according to what I wanted them to mean. And so words like sin and repent, and I wrote down what I wanted them to mean. Repent was just like say sorry, and I could see this little girl self saying sorry, and I said sorry all the time. And so I turned these nasty, scary words into words that made me stay, allowed me to stay open. And when I could accept those things, I could start to have a new concept of a higher power. And then she also told me to write down every characteristic of a higher power that I would want it to mean. And then she told me to write down every little miracle that happened in my life as a result of doing it different and not drinking. And I started noticing that I wanted hugs, that I started feeling love, that I started doing things for others, that so these little miracles started coming, and I started to get this really powerful God concept that changed my life. And I really had arrived. I got a promotion. And then I had this really crazy thought, what if I'm someone who could be a mother? And it, I want to cry now, because when you have PTSD, you don't see yourself in the future. You don't see that you fit anywhere. There's no purpose. You don't even know if you'll make it to tomorrow. And then suddenly I have this future forward thought that maybe I'm somebody who's not too damaged to be a mother. And Josh and I did, a lot of therapy. He joined Al-Anon. And we did about 5 years of therapy. And my therapist is like, you act like if you make this choice, your life is over. Maybe you'll just do a fork in the road. But I don't know that she, I knew that she didn't know that I was grappling with this deep, gross pain that I couldn't see or touch or couldn't name, that I didn't ever want to transfer on. But I really thought that maybe that was cured or healed, because I had this 5 successful years in this program. And I, excuse me, ended up getting pregnant after 1 month of trying. And I was, we were really bonded during that time, and it was beautiful. At the time, I was, using nicotine. I could tell you guys, I was never fully treated in AA. I had a huge, huge surge of health, but I couldn't quit the nicotine. And I would go for 3 days, and here came the darkness. And that's all I could tell you it was called. And it came with suicidal thoughts and hideous sensations in my body that I wouldn't even touch. I just remember going, nope. And then I would ingest it again, and it would shove it back down. And I was also taking ADD medication, and I'm, psychotropic meds have helped me. Antidepressants helped me dissociate enough to have some, have some success. But those ADD meds really, helped. They numbed me out too, because I couldn't, focus if I had all of this trauma lurking in the background that I couldn't face. So I got off of all of that when I was pregnant, except for a small dose of ADD meds. And I, that was my substitute. I had a baby in my body, and, suddenly I'm living out the narrative that my mom did, that I saved her, and I'm going to have this baby save me. And I don't want these things to be peddled down to the next generation. I know that, but it's so ingrained in me. So as after he was born, I started to have terrorizing feelings come up that maybe this was how my mom felt when she had a baby. And my body started breaking down, and the memory started flowing back. So I instantly went back on the medications and started nicotine right away. And at that time, an AA sponsee had handed me the Big Red Book, and she said, I don't know, I've heard some of your story, and I just think this might be relevant for you. And I tossed it aside and wanted nothing to do with it. And I think I stubbed my toe on it one time and like literally hurt my toe. And I was like, what is this stupid book? It's kind of obstinate, threw it in the corner. But I believed I had hit the mark in AA, and I didn't want to go anywhere else. I didn't want to have to belong somewhere else and learn something new. It's hard for us to go belong somewhere. And but what I learned was that AA wasn't talking about what I was feeling, and that what I had going on wasn't fitting. I did what you suggested. I attended 6 meetings. I had to smoke profusely, and I couldn't feel what came up. But and it took me a full year to attend 6. And I was having the most horrible flashbacks I'd ever had. And I dove in deep to the program, and I made a commitment that I would face all of it. And I remember tossing in the nicotine and just kind of making that decision. And I can tell you, at the same time, I started to realize the miracle state of us as babies and children, because I had a baby that was an absolute miracle, and he was so beautiful and sparkly. And I was so scared. It was excruciating knowing how much love that he was, and how much I had for him, and how I could not attach. I was so scared to hurt him and wound him and transfer this. And that it's the worst feeling I've ever known, wanting to bond and being so scared to transfer something at the exact same time. But the baby was beautiful, and I'm thankful I had him, because now I can see who I was when I was born. In 2021, I finally started the steps, and I decided I was going to get off these antidepressants and take the leap and see if this program could transform me. I had a really terrible time getting off of the medications. I ended up having to go to the hospital for 2 weeks, and I was really blended with these trauma states. And I remember laying in bed crying one night, and I heard a voice say that no one's coming. And I realized I'd been crying my whole life for somebody to come, for something to come, to be saved. And it was this new permission to stop taking care of everyone else and start taking care of myself. I had met my inner child for the first time. I did the non-dominant handwriting, and I didn't believe in it, but I let someone guide me for once. And she showed me where she was. She was sitting in a tunnel in kindergarten, curled up in a ball. And I went and sat by her and I touched the terror that she felt every single day of her life. And it makes me want to weep because I don't feel that right now. I feel like she's like, I feel like we're, connected and she's right here and she's not crippling and crippled in fear. I have a met a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I found a therapist who taught me how to tolerate my feelings. He's a somatic guy, and I want to pull out of these feelings all the time. And he takes me back, and he's so gentle. He'll say, "I know your head wants to go here, but I'm wondering if we can just drop right back in for a minute, and I'll let him guide me back into my feelings." And I sit for an hour, shaking and wanting to get out of there, but now I don't want to shake. I don't want to run anymore. I can actually sit in it, and I call this the vault. We come in, we open the vault, and we learn that when we get here, we finally access our grief. And so there's three things, three hallmarks of my recovery today that are indispensable: forgiveness, grief, and reparenting. Because everything that comes up is in the past and it's done. And if I get trapped in blame, I relive it over and over. And what I've learned in the book, it says right here that the loss, we realize that when we're grieving the losses, our parents, we realize that we see the losses that our parents have endured as children. And in grief work, we find it easier to have forgiving thoughts for them because we have forgiving thoughts for ourselves. And we have begun to separate from our family of origin. So when I get to forgive my mom, I get to take responsibility for my own children. And when my children are set free from attachments to these humans who aren't capable of giving them what they need, they don't need to trigger anymore. But I will tell you that, every trigger I have today is my entry point to an unhealed experience inside of me. And so I won't say I welcome triggers. I certainly don't. They're sometimes very inconvenient and at the worst times, and they are hijacking. But I always know it's one of my littles like tugging me and saying, "This didn't go well once. Can I tell you what happened?" And I'll have to slow down. But it's seductive to grab onto the circumstance that caused the trigger and want to blame that. And then I take on that victim trait, and I can't do that. So when I'm, when these things are healed, these outside things don't bother me as much anymore. So I really have used, tried to use triggers as an opportunity to heal. When I was 1 year sober and I got married, my dad walked me down the aisle. And I got to make amends to him for how I treated him in my drinking days. I even apologized to him for having so much shame while he was at that time of his life of coming out. And he said, "That's not your fault, at all." And he, acknowledged that he wasn't there for me. And 4 months later, he died of a heart attack. And at the same time that we were getting married, my mom came to my wedding, our wedding, evicted. And so when my dad was gone, my mom suddenly came home, and my brother with Down syndrome, I became guardian of. And he had said, months before he died, "If anything happens to me, will you take John?" And I was like, "Nothing will happen to you. So no, yeah, sure." And we had John overnight, and my mom signed over rights because she had, such severe addiction that she couldn't take care to caregive for him anyway. But when she came home, she cleaned up. She did everything she could. And I watched her get a second chance to reparent John. And I'm watching that happen right now. And it's amazing. We ended up moving again. And my mom had relapsed on opiates last year. And she was in the hospital, and she held my hand and she said, "Amy, I really don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to use drugs anymore. I just get so lonely." And I said, "I know you don't, Mom." And I genuinely meant that. I know she doesn't want to do this. I know she wants to be treated just like I do. And she didn't grab the tools. And it was the first time in my life I didn't feel like I needed to coach her or belittle her or give her some, feedback. I've just felt calm and compassionate and empathetic. And it's because I've worked these steps, and my children don't need her to be okay for me to be okay. And I was freed up to love her where she was at. She came and stayed with me last weekend, and she, has a walker, and she cut her hand when she was trying to open something, and she just started shaking. And I got to, put a Band-Aid on her hand and hold her shoulders, and so she could calm down and nurture her in ways she never could nurture me. And I just thought that there's, these are the miracles. It's a miracle that, and there's nowhere else I would rather be than engaging in these things that you guys taught me and like in really fulfilling these promises. And it's a daily dance because there are some days I can't do that for her. I can't do that for anybody. I have to, my parts are talking to me. And so I have to be really diligent to take care of them. Today, the most precious reward and gift of this work is presence. When I got sober, I could not believe how much time there was in a day. I was so numbed for so long that I was working or drinking, and I was like, what do people do all day? That you just kind of sit here and there's choices. You can make all these choices. And I didn't know what to do with them and a calm nervous system. You know, that's scary for us. It's like I would create chaos, so addicted, go dig into drama or start a fight or something or go on a shopping spree, do something. So it's taken me years to really sit in presence. And guess what's here? This sparkling 6-year-old child. He's magic. We went to bed the other night and he was couldn't fall asleep, and he was talking and he said, who tickles your hands when you were little when you needed to fall asleep? And I said, no one tickled my hands. Who laid with you? And I said, no one laid with me. And he just welled up. No one laid with you? And I didn't mean to like burden him at all. I was just comparing our lives, and he was just shocked. And I just feel really grateful that he gets to have a new experience. We also did this little rainbow meditation, and it's like we're doing a rainbow meditation. And I remember, I'm not taking it lightly, but getting chased down the hall with the belt, get your ass in bed, and whoever was last got the spanking. And so there's a lot of, gratitude that I feel when I am present. I want to talk quickly about takeovers. Those, that's in the Nurturing Parent, the parenting book, which I absolutely love. I'm part of a work group on that one. And, they talk about how to deal with takeovers and how to take a breath and separate yourself from that part and try to get back in the driver's seat. I heard someone say earlier that, when I think Denise, I'm in the driver's seat, the loving parent. And that book is, I take it everywhere. Like I'll open it up and go to the appendix on takeover because I know that I'm not right. But this journey has really been about returning to love. It's about returning to my miracle state. And the book, it says that we came out perfectly ready to love our parents unconditionally. Like that was our gift to them. And nobody, we knew it. We just knew. And they weren't ready to receive the gift. They couldn't. And so we felt rejection. And in that rejected state, we learned to tuck it down deep, deep down. And when we get here, we get to unburden. And that miracle state is just sitting there waiting to be tapped. And so, on a daily basis, doing this kind of stuff and connecting with you and sharing little by little, I get to tap into that love. I'm here. I've laid roots. I'm allowing this process. And our format is what I was like, or what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I'll tell you that what I am like today is a combination of what happened to me also. Like Sawyer, my son, hits these new milestones, and I relive my first grade, and it was awful. I have flashbacks every time I see him go to a new milestone. I have a part telling me what it was like for her in that time. And so this is a duality for me. I'm grieving and living forward. And I had this epiphany that I have to change my relationship with grief. I cannot avoid this thing. So I went to my somatic therapist and, all right, I've got the goal. Be good at grief. He's like, okay, Amy, well, so make me good at grief because there's no way I'm doing attachments if I can't grieve. And that's it. That's the answer. I don't know. It's messy and funky, but there is the process, and they do live side by side. And I've said this before, but I can either live in a state of connection or a state of protection. And when I'm triggered, I have a false self that lunges in front of me and decides that protection is going to be the better answer. And that's a trauma response. And so I have to coax that part of me off and say consciously, I choose connection. That is, this whole thing is a disease of connection. It started in attachment wounding. We got are d diseased at this point. And so, the answer is the thing that we're diseased in, and that's to promote more connection. We have to keep leaning into this stuff and calling each other. Today, I'm so thankful that I can mostly live forward. I've sat in a flashback for days at a time, and it's really scary. And all I can do is stay the path and come to meetings and hope I hear something you say that keeps me coming. I have rules. I do not use drugs or alcohol. I go to the meetings and I go to bed on time. There are these things that my parts want to do to act out, but we have rules. And inevitably, I will come out of those flashbacks. They're fewer and far between. And so mostly I get to live forward. I get to make plans and I get to follow through with my plans and have a new experience of life. That's a good day. And when I get to tell my story, I get
Yes.
to Thank you. I get to come more and more out of hiding, and I get to go from, hurting to healing and to hopefully helping. Like I hope somebody heard something today that wants them to keep going, or that, that tells you that recovery is possible, because it very much is. And I'm so thankful for that. And that's all I have. Thank you so much for having me.